Going on, everyone. It's Dr. Mike T. Nelson here with Not Another Fitness Podcast. And today I've got an awesome interview from my buddy Phil White, who you may not necessarily recognize the name, but he is a co-author with Dr. Andy Gelpin, who's been on this program before, Brian McKenzie of the book Unplugged. He's worked with a fair amount of other people you probably recognize, especially with the name Kelly Starrett, Laird Hamilton, and others. So we talk about all those cast of characters. And the reason I wanted him on here is I'm always fascinated by people with diverse backgrounds, especially someone such as Phil, who's primarily, I'd say, a journalist and a writer. How they view things and how can they take their skill set of looking at it a little bit as an outsider, which is a good thing, and explain it to a little bit wider audience. I know a lot of times I feel like I spend maybe too much time, if that's possible, down the old PubMed rabbit hole reading stuff, and it's good to pop your head out once in a while and to figure out how can you put all these concepts together. And how can you relay them in a way, especially using the art of story, so that people can understand it? And of course, story can be sort of bastardized for the wrong reason. Hence, the movie Game Changers is probably an example of that, where you don't necessarily need to get the science right, but it's a cool story. So anyway, check out this interview with Phil. If you have any comments for me, by all means, hit me up, leave me a comment on the old iTunes, wherever you listen to this podcast. And if you enjoyed this, go to my website, which is just www.miketnelson.com. And at the very top, there's a way to get onto the semi-daily newsletter. So if you want more fitness tips directly into your inbox for free, and I sort of ethically bribe you with a gift there too, make sure to check that out. So, www.miketnelson.com, and enjoy the interview here with Phil. Hey, what's going on? It's Dr. Mike T. Nelson here with Not Another Fitness Podcast for fitness geeks only. And today I have a super cool interview joined by Phil White here. And again, one of the things I wanted to do with this podcast is kind of bring people that you may have been kind of familiar with, but you're like, oh, I've heard that guy's name before, but I don't really know what or where. And Phil's done some very cool writing with a lot of top authors. I'll have him do the intro coming up here. And we wanted to talk about, since he has such a very cool experience, especially writing and getting all the infinite details on each person, what are kind of the overlapping themes that we see? So kind of the big rocks that you can apply to your fitness routine for better performance and body comp. So thank you very much, Phil, for being here.
Oh, thanks for having me. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, so give some of the listeners a little bit of background on yourself, and then who specifically you've worked with.
Yeah, so I have had the pleasure of kind of having a real world writing apprenticeship under the likes of Kelly Starrett. We wrote a book called Waterman 2.0, which is really a set of standards for all paddlers, rowers, surfers, and humans, I would say, of what your body should be able to do for optimal performance. And if it can't, some ways to fix yourself without having to shell out for a PT. And then also wrote Unplugged with Dr. Andy Galpin, who's a muscle physiologist at Cal State Fullerton, and Brian McKenzie, that people probably know through his book Power Speed Endurance and the website of the same name. And then also worked with Fergus Conley on kind of a magnum opus on preparing team sports athletes, and really a health-focused perspective on in doing so. And then most recently wrote a book with Dr. Frank Merritt, who is actually an emergency room physician down in Florida, who's also board certified in internal medicine. And I believe we're going to have a conversation, the three of us, Mike, with Dr. Merritt here in a few weeks. So looking forward to that. But really, the 17-hour fast, I think, is the only fasting book I'm aware of out there written by an emergency room MD who does have that board certification in internal medicine. Like, parentheses, this isn't some blogger or influencer who's trying to hop on the fasting bandwagon and make some money. And as the title would suggest, is really a minimum effective dose for a weekly fast, with the main difference being that there's an off-ramp, an on-ramp with how you tailor your pre- and post-fast meals so that you get a lot of the benefits of a longer, say a 24 or even 36-hour fast without the misery that's often involved in that, at least the first time people do it.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. And we'll have a chat with him coming up, so I'm looking forward to that. I'm actually fasting as we speak when we're doing this recording, so looking forward to that. How did you get into just kind of general health and fitness? I'm always curious as to people's backgrounds, because there's usually something that kind of drove them in that direction, especially to do like yourself and make a whole career out of it.
Yeah, so I think I played basketball and soccer at a small college, Mid-American Nazarene University and NAIA school in Kansas City. And so that's when I came over from England to the States in 2001. But even before that point, I was starting to get some jumpers knee issues and some other, you know, the familiar ankle sprains that all basketball players know and hate. And really just, you know, was wanting to get to that level where I would be recruited by colleges and could equip myself well at the college level in two different sports. And so really just fascinated by human performance from a young age, and then obviously played two sports in college. And then after college, I was writing for Sup the Mag, which is the kind of stand-up paddleboarding equivalent of Surfer Magazine, and in the same media group. And I was kind of charged with getting them a bit more up to speed on the health and fitness beat. And Kelly Starrett, really, we didn't know each other at this point, but I jacked up my back deadlifting a couple of years after college. And my wife and I have always had terrible health insurance, and that was certainly the case at the time. And something felt like a hand grenade going off in my lower back. And I thought, well, that's going to be expensive if I go down the traditional medicine route. And so what else could I do? And so just started, you know, doing the usual on Google and found Kelly's work and really managed to fix myself. And that problem really isolated with a super tight left glute and super tight left hip. Mm. And so I just pitched my editor, and I don't think he knew what the concept of mobility or even movement quality meant at that point. But Joe Carberry, one of the great water sports journalists of our generation, really, he just said, yeah, sure, that sounds interesting. Go ahead and do a Q&A with him. And then Kelly kindly did a video for the magazine, and we just kept in touch. And he was working on the book Ready to Run with TJ Murphy at that point.
Okay.
But a lot of people don't know that how Kelly Starrett became what he is, Supple Leopard, is that he was on the Whitewater National Slalom Canoe Team and, you know, paddling two to three times a day, 300 days a year down in Durango here in Colorado, and buggered up his shoulder. And when that happened, he went to the head coach and was obviously pretty concerned. And the coach said, well, you know, everyone, this happens to everyone. It's just a volume issue. We're paddling so much. And every girl on his team had at least one shoulder surgery at this point. So the coach said, you know, just have the surgery, come back, and, you know, your place will be waiting. And Kelly was not really satisfied by the, well, that's just what happens answer. So in Waterman 2.0, we really tell his full origin story, which, you know, you can't find in Ready to Run or any, it was obviously Supple Leopard, his other books. And it's also, he's just passionate about helping other paddlers, which was really what took him from fixing himself to going to PT school and then starting what's now rebranded as the Ready State, which was previously Mobility WOD. And really, so just learning from Kelly, and then he connected with me with Brian McKenzie and Andy Galpin. We wrote Unplugged together, and then just all the other books flowed out of that.
Oh, that's awesome. I've known Andy for quite a few years, and he was actually the first interview we had on the podcast here. And I saw Kelly and his wonderful wife in Tahoe a couple months ago, actually. Again, we were out there for the Spartan World Championship doing some podcasting stuff. So, yeah, small world.
It really is.
Yeah. How did you get into the more fitness and, I guess, with the health stint on it in terms of journalism and writing? A good buddy of mine is Lou Schuler, who when I was coming along, was one of the first people I saw who went back and, you know, went to journalism school and then went back and got his, you know, CSCS and did a lot of writing for Team Egg and Men's Health and many other magazines. How did you decide to kind of go more with the journalism writing bent on it?
Yeah, so I was initially an athletic training major in college, but soon decided that that wasn't for me, and so switched to English. Oh. And I'd always loved storytelling, you know, grew up with a storytelling Irish grandmother. My mom was a freelance journalist for quite a while and contributed to quite a few of the big publications in England. And so always kind of been around that type of storytelling in my home and my relatives' homes. But I think that just recognizing that I had some great professors in college, and one of them had me do an assignment. It was just an open assignment to the whole class. So find someone interesting on campus to interview, which is about as open-ended as it gets, right? And so just a family friend of my future wife, Nicole, this guy, Roland Gilliland, he worked for the kind of on-campus maintenance team, I guess you could say, doing the locks and this type of thing. But in his spare time, he was a safecracker for the FBI, as one does, oh, wow. You know, that kind of thing. And just really interesting guy, you know. He would go skydiving and crow hunting and all this different. So this is really eclectic, unique personality. And so I did my profile on him, and she really liked it and passed it to one of the other advisors, who was really our kind of adjunct newspaper professors, Kevin Wright. And he was the editor of the Olathe Daily News, Olathe being the suburb of Kansas City where that college is located. And so I got back from winter break in England, and my future mother-in-law said, oh, did you see the Olathe Daily News? And I said, no. And she said, well, that story you did on Roland is on the front page. And so really from that cover story, it was just kind of validation that I wasn't delusional and I could write a little bit. And then obviously being a two-sport athlete, just kind of put the two passions for human performance and then writing together. And this is what came out the other end.
Oh, that's super cool. I just recently, a while back, read the book Range by David Epstein.
And Dave's a good friend. Yeah, it's fantastic.
I love his writing style, and I love all the homework and stuff he does. And I always find it interesting, and he makes the comment on this too, if you can find two areas that you can be pretty high level at and then get those two areas to overlap, you can go pretty far with that, especially in today's modern world, compared to the amount of time and effort it would take to be, you know, the elite of the elite or way up at the top. And even just working with athletes, you see that, right? You see a lot of athletes who are really good, but man, the amount of time and effort to get to that elite status is a lot compared to maybe you can just take two things and be pretty darn good at them and get those to overlap, and you can now make a whole career out of it, which is fascinating.
Yeah, I agree. And I think he really does a great job of explaining what he calls the network effect in that book.
Yeah.
And it shows that it took him the best part of 6.5 years to write After the Sports Gene. And the great thing about Dave is that he was unwilling to be conformed to the mold of being the Sports Gene guy.
Yeah.
So he didn't just want to write the Sports Gene parts 2, 3, and 4, but really wants to follow his curiosity where it goes, to challenge his assumptions, challenge himself. And if anyone listening has the chance to hear any podcasts with him, and he tells his story of he was one of the two journalists, one of his female colleagues, and he broke the Alex Rodriguez PED story. And so he went from the peak of the senior writer kind of cadre at Sports Illustrated to working at ProPublica when it was a nascent startup for about $50 a day, I think it worked out at. And so really just the lesson that I've taken from Dave, other than the fact that he's obviously such a great writer and researcher and so broad-minded, is that sometimes to be willing to move forward, you have to go backwards. And that's, I think that's true in any profession or even in your own health.
Yeah, I think about that in terms of even performance too. Like even just this week with my own training, like a couple of the main lifts I've been working on were, and for about like 2 weeks, just did not feel good. Like performance wasn't very good. And, you know, sometimes I'm a little bit slow, especially when it's about yourself. I'm like, wait a minute, why am I still beating against the same area and just kind of change gears a little bit and, you know, hit like a couple of big PRs on other lifts that are associated with those. And I know once I go back to the main lifts that they'll, you know, probably be going good again. So it's kind of an interesting lesson about what are kind of the big rocks. And sometimes to get to them, you have to take a little bit of a circuitous route. The direct path, while on paper is the shortest, it's not always in practicality the best way to go about it.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, my friend Joe DeLeo is a coach in Kansas City and works primarily in rowing, but is also a certified strong first instructor. And he's posted quite a bit about kettlebell work for endurance sports. And we did a piece for Train Heroic some time ago on this. But even with Olympic caliber college rowers, you know, the elite of the elite in college rowing, and these are big old powerful guys, you know, a lot of them are 6'4", 6'5", 220. They look like rugby players, you know, they're big, big dudes. But he starts them with what he believes is one of the best exercises for rowers, given that they're doing so much volume, just on low rep, low total volume kettlebell swings. And then when they've mastered that, the snatch. And a lot of them are only working with 14 or 16 kg bells. And you see this giant guy with a little bell and you think, well, that's not very much. But it's obviously enough to produce the training stimulus that an adaptation that Joe's looking for with these guys and girls. And then, you know, that just shows that it's not about ego. Just because this guy's a powerhouse and can probably pull a, you know, sub 630 2K on the rowing machine, which most of us could only dream about.
That's insane. They're,
yeah, I mean, they're going back to basics with the kettlebell work, making sure they know how to do a body weight hip hinge properly, then progressing to doing some hip hinging with just a single bell, you know, kind of that narrower stance. And then from there, going to the swing and again, just a light snatch. And I said, well, you know, they're getting up to, you know, 24 kg or above single arm snatches with the kettlebell eventually. And he's like, no, why would I need to take them up that far? And so, again, just it's great to be able to learn from people like Joe and others that sometimes it doesn't need, it's not about ego and it's not about, you know, big person has to shift big weight to make big adaptation, because often that isn't the case.
Yeah, especially probably in that case, too, where that's a new movement to them. It's probably got a high amount of transfer to the rowing stroke. So they, if it's new, they probably don't need to go super crazy, especially if, you know, technique is going to fall off and your risk reward ratio kind of heads south, and you just don't need to be that aggressive to start either.
That's right.
So talking about kind of some big rocks out of all the people you've worked with, it's, I think especially now in the kind of social media age, it's always easy to poke holes of like, oh, this is so different, and this guy said this, and this guy said that in one sentence. But I think a lot of times we miss what are the big picture, like what are some of the commonalities of areas that they overlap that we can implement into our lifestyle for, you know, health and performance.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's the genius is in all of these folks that I've been blessed to work with and work under and kind of support from a writing standpoint and kind of getting their ideas and just being the channel to an audience that can hopefully benefit from those ideas. And so I think one of them would be Andy Galpin. A while ago, we worked on a post for XPT, which is Laird Hamilton and Gabby Reese's company, Extreme Performance Training. And it was really just giving a basic weekly plan for better health and fitness. And what it came down to was twice a week doing strength training. And Andy went into some of the research that two out of the four main markers for not just longevity, but vitality in your later years are related to strength. So I believe one is leg strength and the second of those is grip strength.
Yeah, correct.
And so we know that, you know, a lot of people say, well, I know that muscle mass declines over time, but Andy's point is, and he does muscle biopsies, let's remember, every day, so we can take his word for it, that it isn't just that muscle declines, but it's the decline in fast twitch muscle. And actually a lot of falls happen in older people because they are not, when they feel themselves starting to go down, they're not able to shift that back foot to the front foot, get their weight back under them and course correct. and that is mainly due to the decline of fast twitch muscle. So his point is you should train strength twice a week, do some power work at the start of those sessions. Before, you know, we want to do our fastest things first. So whether that's sprinting, a little plyometrics, and this should be very low dose. It could be as little as 5 to 10 minutes. Then do your strength work. And now a couple of other days a week, you should do some interval training. So one I like is, say, 10 minutes fast on the rower broken up into 1 minute segments. So 1 minute fast and then 1 minute slow or 1 minute off. Or even if you did 6 or 7 of those, a longer warm up, a longer cool down, because you're going to get that lactic burn otherwise. And then once or twice a week, just do some endurance work where you're never going above about 80% of your maximum heart rate, and you're probably more around that kind of 55 to 75%. And this is where that this second kind of big rock comes in. That could literally be as simple as go take a walk outside for 30 to 45 minutes.
Yeah, especially if you're on the more deconditioned and not doing a lot of formal exercise.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that Andy also says, you know, if there are certain exercise, should we say, systems or fads out there where people are redlining every day. But that's why we're starting to see guys like Kelly and Brian keep a spreadsheet of athletes that have just, you know, buggered themselves to the point of being told you have adrenal fatigue, and if you train hard in the next 6 months, you might die. So we shouldn't yet get to that point. And Andy said, you know, you've got to move every day, but a lot of the time that intensity level should be no higher than 4 or 5 out of 10. And so you should only be going to this 9 or even 10 out of 10 twice a week, essentially, for the general population. Now, obviously, if you're a specific athlete at a certain point in a periodization cycle and you can handle more volume, you can handle more load and intensity, that might change. But just general population. And the rest of the time, you know, even when I talk to Andy, and it's less frequent than both of us would like, but invariably he's out for a walk pushing a stroller with his kid in and another one on the way. So it's that's a habit that he's added into his daily life. I know Kelly and Juliet are big on that, you know, and the walking the kids to school.
Yeah.
And so I think that even just backing it off of that plan that Andy talked about, the simplest thing that you can do to improve your daily health, other than improving your sleep, and we'll get to that in a minute, it is just to take a daily walk, preferably outside when weather allows.
Yeah, I'm a huge fan of that, and obviously I have a whole certification course. I talk all about that, and you're looking at big rocks and stuff that has a lot of overlap, right? So in the AM, you probably fasted, right? So maybe you get a little bit more use of fat as a fuel. It's super easy. It's low intensity. You don't need to friggin' warm up for it. You just start walking outside. You know, as you talked about, we'll get into sleep. You get the sunlight effect into the eyeballs that helps reset your circadian rhythm. You know, there's stuff with how the eyes move, because a lot of people are used to staring at phones and screens all day, right? Those little muscles around the eyeballs get tight, just like your hip flexors from sitting so much. So go outside, look around at the tops of trees, try to look at stuff far away. And I think for something that almost everybody can do also, there's a lot of benefits to it that people sometimes forget.
Yeah, and Andy says that, you know, if we look at, say, the Blue Zones book, that everyone thinks, there's this soup that they eat in Sardinia that has fennel in it, and it has beans in it, and all the... They're missing the point again, and it's missing the wood for the trees. Like, they're healthy because they live in a hilly region of Italy, and they walk an average of, what is it, like 6.5 miles a day up and down a hillside. So they have to go up and down the hill to go into the village to get groceries. They have to do the same to go meet their buddies for espresso, you know, and it's just and then obviously we start to get into things like being in authentic community, as you kind of just alluded to, more FaceTime and less FaceTime. And we start to see some of those commonalities. But again, that's an example, and that's such a great book. But again, I think people start to try to identify, well, you must drink red wine, or you must eat this soup 3 times a week or whatever. And it's like, really? Or is it just that they're in rich, genuine community? They're not on screens a lot. They hardly ever sit, and they walk around all day, and they're outdoors a lot. Aren't those really the big factors here? But I think that that's, you mentioned in the intro and quite correctly, that we see LeBron James doing like a one-legged squat on a BOSU ball with some kind of weight before the game. And we think that that's for us. Well, it's like, well, I'm pretty sure at that point LeBron was coming back from an injury, so he was probably missing some proprioception.
Yeah.
So that was an appropriate intervention from an experienced trainer. But you're not LeBron James, and neither am I. So while some of the things that he does, you know, day to day might be appropriate, that kind of return from injury protocol blew up, and now you see all these people posting them recreating this move in the gym and like, oh, be like LeBron, this kind of hashtag nonsense. And again, just taken way out of context. And I think sometimes we want to hop on that next bandwagon so quickly that it speeds off with us hanging off the back of it. And in doing so, we blow right by the small things that could actually yield bigger results in our health and wellness.
Yeah, it seems like as humans overall, it's almost in our tendency to try to pull out the one thing. Like, what's the single factor of, oh, it's the French, they must have had, you know, red wine, or it's the special soup, or it's this thing, it's the special rehab protocol. And we tend to forget just context entirely. And that rarely is there ever just one sort of simple solution per se. It's always much more complicated than what it is. And that's probably why you and I have jobs. So.
Right. But it is. I mean, look at the book, The Secret. I think one of the reasons that certain books sell so well is because they have great titles. Well, yes. What is The Secret? I want to find out. I'm going to read that book, right? It's a guy, it's upselling millions of copies.
And it's The Secret, not The 1700 Secrets.
Yeah, exactly. And also, I mean, another, to Andy's point, you know, he says a lot that it depends. And that can annoy interviewers somewhat beyond a certain point, but he's correct, because if you're not sure what it is you're trying to achieve, then I think we need to start, or as Fergus Connolly, my co-author on Game Changer, puts it, like, we need to start with game day and work backwards from there, as pro sports teams do. This is why they call the day before, like, game day minus one, and then the day before that is game day minus two, etc. And they create all their protocols for everything, nutrition, training, travel, team meetings around this schedule, because ultimately game day is all that matters. And it doesn't matter if you're LeBron, if you are a stay-at-home mom or dad, if you're a business person, we all have a certain game day. And a lot of us, it's every day rather than just once a week on a Sunday or a Saturday. And so really, start with game day and start with your game day goals. What is it you're trying to achieve in your career this year? What is it that you're trying to achieve in your health? And just do one thing at a time. Like, if you're, like you were saying earlier, having patience, what Steve Magnus and Brad Stolberg in The Passion Paradox talk about, spending time on the plateau, mm-hmm. and just putting in those miles, you know, or like runners would, or climbers climbing a lot of easy routes before they try an Alex Honnold type stunt, that kind of thing. So it's, but we want to free solo El Capitan. We want to go out and serve 70-foot waves like lead. And often we're not preparing ourselves and realizing that lead can only do that because he's been in the water every day since he was 3 years old.
Yeah. And you're probably not Laird.
probably not this 6'3" fish man, freaking nature, Aquaman or something. So, yeah, but I think going back to Andy's point, that you have to, people say start with why, but I think sometimes you have to start with what. And that's what is it you're trying to achieve, and therefore, what are the strategies to get you there, and what is the minimum effective dose of each of these strategies that's going to advance the ball? And then try one variable, like Andy would in the lab, right? In a scientific study, they're not introducing 700 variables and then hoping they all combine or one of them works. It's one thing, test the hypotheses. Well, if you're wrong, maybe test something else and see if that's it, and just keep going. And some scientists will do this their entire life with one very narrow set of variables, and that will be their life's work. So why aren't we applying the same kind of rational minimalism to what we do? But what we often apply is the opposite, irrational maximalism.
Yeah, and working with clients, I find that's probably one of the hardest things, is trying to narrow down their goals and, you know, kind of like what Dan John has said, keeping the goal, you know, for a set period of time. And I'm fine if they want to change goals. That's totally cool. They're in control of that. But trying to get them to narrow down into, okay, we're going to take this amount of time. This is the number one goal. Here's our parameters. Here's our constraints, and set it up so that we'll get as close as we can and try to limit the variables. If we're testing something different, ideally I like to set it up where if that little experiment doesn't work, then that information will tell us what the next thing is. So that way you're still kind of failing forward as fast as possible in the process then too.
Sure. And Fabio Zonin, who is the CEO of Strong First, so if you don't know what that is, go listen to the Joe Rogan episode with Pavel. Recently, which is only the second podcast interview he's ever done. And then
that's what I was thinking,
Then go listen to the Tim Ferriss one before that. But he Fabio told me something really interesting recently when we were talking about a strength protocol for Strong First, and I don't want to give too much away. I write a monthly post for them. It's usually ghostwritten or it's a Q&A. But I asked him about how he varied nutrition, and he's like a champion, you know, he's like the Italian multi-Italian champion in natural bodybuilding. Guy's just an unbelievable specimen and has a great mind as well. But what did you do differently, Fabio, with these athletes and yourself when we were testing these strength and hypertrophy protocols? And he said, I didn't change anything about the diet. And I thought, how can that be right? And then he elaborated. He said, I wanted to make sure that it was the protocol itself that was producing the hypertrophy. So I told them, keep eating what you're eating right now. And I was like, wow. And then maybe that shouldn't have been that shocking to me, but it was at the time.
Oh, yeah, because a lot of people want to change multiple things at once. And if I have someone where we can't really narrow them down, then I'm going to narrow the time course, right? I'm like, okay, we will try on your recommendation these four things, but we're going to do that for a four-week period, and then we're going to eval, are you closer or farther away from your goal? If we're closer, all right, then we can try to maybe figure out which one of those things has the biggest factor related to it if you want. And if we're not, then, okay, you're kind of a little bit screwed then, because now you've kind of lost 4 weeks and you don't really know where to go from that point. So that's what makes it hard.
Mm-hmm.
Awesome. And last part on the training is, I do definitely agree with polarized training, and even looking at, you know, what Laird and Alex Hommel and those people have done, I think it's not sexy, and what people forget, you know, even with like the Free Solo movie, if people have ever watched it, it's just phenomenal. But about how much time he spent doing quote unquote easy climbs for him, right, which are insane for other people, but that was a year, I think it was 2.5 years or something. I may have the time course wrong.
Yeah, and then,
but
then
it's years, it's not months of, can I make this as easy as possible in these set chunks?
And if you look at Tommy Caldwell, I just went with a good friend last night to see the nose speed record, which is by the same team that did the Dawn Wall movie, which is, haven't seen it, check that out. It's incredible. So Tommy Caldwell and Alex Honnold, so the greatest big wall climber, Tommy Caldwell of all time, mm-hmm. teams up with the greatest free soloist of all time to try to break the record of climbing the nose on El Capitan. And it's fascinating. So right now it's just, real rock, 14, you know, cities around the world. So go check it out if you can. Really fascinating. There's three other short films with it. But the Dawn Wall, which I'll usually watch Free Solo again one night and then watch the Dawn Wall the following night because it's a great companion piece. But Tommy took, I think, the best part of 8 years trying to put together the route on the Dawn Wall. And so people might say, and this is another great example, going back to what we were talking about earlier of missing the wood for the trees. So this young hotshot climber and his partner, after Caldwell and Jorgensen finally figured out the route, put it together and climbed the Dawn Wall, you know, it took them over 2 weeks, came and blitzed it in 7 or 8 days. So people, if we focus too much on just one data point, which is, you know, just the outcome, so whether it's time or it's, you know, speed, whatever it is, power, one rep max, we can often miss the real point of it. So someone might say, yeah, but then those two other guys went out a few weeks later and just annihilated their time and did it in less than half the time. But what we're missing here is context, that it did take Tommy Caldwell 8 years. Jorgensen was with him for the last few of those years, and twice a year for months they would go back up to Yosemite, for these long times away from their family, figuring out the routes, trying this one move over and over again. And actually there's a dino move in it, which is a two-handed spider monkey jump about 8 feet sideways to their left.
Makes my palms sweaty just hearing it.
Yeah, and Tommy rebuilt it on the side of his garage in Estes Park and never got it. And Jorgensen, well, you'll see what happens in the movie. But it's literally, and it shows archival footage of him doing this on the side of his garage in the Estes Park winter, you know, the snow's blowing around. And so, yeah, okay, these two other guys went up there and tranced their, you know, the second attempt was way quicker than the first, but they didn't have to put the route together.
Yeah.
They weren't the ones that went up there. And Jorgensen previously was a boulderer who'd never climbed more than about 40, 50 feet.
Hmm.
So 3,000 feet. And again, to Epstein's point, having to sometimes go back to square one to relearn something or learn something new, then the network effect, you lateralize over to what you're trying to do now, and it all comes together. So my point being that context is everything. And as Andy says, it does depend. And to David Epstein's point in range, everything does feed back into everything else. So there are probably things in your life and experiences that you've had where you're like, man, I hated work in retail. Yeah. But maybe that taught you patience and how to deal with people and try to be more helpful to them, that then you go and apply to in later life when you're, you know, trying to go for that promotion next year, or you're trying to be a better coach, say. And so I think if we're honest with ourselves and we look back at those experiences, try to recontextualize and take some positive lessons from every area of your life thus far and see how that can actually equip you to get to that next goal, rather than just saying, well, that was a weird time in my life. I sure hated that, and just dismissing it. Because I think that Epstein's point is that a lot of these people that were successful in later life at one thing, like Roger Federer in tennis, that came out of them dabbling and trying and failing in many other things, which in Federer's case was pretty much every other sport under the sun. So, yeah, really interesting that it comes back to context and also our willingness to even acknowledge the power of the network effect, and that things that we could be contextualizing as negative could actually be reframed as learning experiences if only we were willing to consider, you know, that the lines might cross, like Caldwell and Jorgensen on the dorm wall, and might actually lead to something, maybe not climbing 3,000 vertical feet of flat granite, but something big.
Yeah, I'm convinced that's why I was in college forever, because I had done so many crappy jobs, from, you know, restaurants, doing dishes, throwing clay pigeons, to putting heads on Pocahontas dolls at one point on a friggin' assembly line. That I was utterly convinced I don't want to do any of this stuff the rest of my life, and I'm probably going to overcompensate and make sure that education is not a limiting factor. So probably went a little bit too far in that direction. But yeah, it's all those experiences that kind of make you and drive you in the direction that you end up, which is useful.
For sure.
So what are some other big rocks that you've learned in your process?
I think one, and mainly through Brian McKenzie, is just the ability to understand first and then to be able to manipulate your breathing to control your state and either elevate or downregulate. And so a lot of people kind of came to the Wim Hof method through his own teachings and then his early partnership with XPT.
Mm-hmm.
But then, so that's, you know, those protocols can be really useful for elevating your nervous system and your state, right? If you're super tired and you have an event that day, or you have, you know, one of your kids has been homesick and up coughing and crying half the night, but you've got the big board presentation, or you just want to have a really productive training session. So you could do some Wim Hof breathing to elevate your state. But then guys like Patrick McKeown, author of The Oxygen Advantage, which is a brilliant book, and if you haven't read it, you must. And then guys like Brian started figuring out, yeah, but what if I want to down-regulate? Because I think a lot of us, you know, if you look at the numbers on sales of pre-workout supplements, this is a massive industry, and it's only getting bigger.
Yeah.
So we're caffeinating ourselves at the eyeballs. We're taking this thing that's like an equivalent of a protein shake and six Red Bulls to jack us up. If we're tired, we're blocking the adenosine receptors with caffeine and heaven knows what else. And we've got really good at cycling up, right? And so something like holotropic breathing or Wim Hof can help you cycle up further. But then if you start to pay attention to guys like I just mentioned, and then another gentleman by the name of Casper van der Meulen, who has another great book called Mind Lift. Casper says that the breath is the remote control for the brain and the nervous system. There are lots of levers and knobs that we can use to control the parasympathetic nervous system. And a lot of the time, in our crazy modern screen-addicted world, we're stuck in the sympathetic branch of that, and we need to be able to cross over into the parasympathetic. So you can try contrast therapy, so hot and cold, and you don't even have to do sauna plus ice bath, which a lot of people hate the ice bath. Just take a hot bath and then take a cold shower for a minute or two, and you'll get 80, 90% of the benefit. But the easiest and most time-efficient way, again, we're all strapped for time, is just to focus on your breath for maybe 5 minutes in the evening before bed. And the easiest way to do it is to breathe in slow through your nose and breathe out slower through your nose. And then if you want to add another layer of complexity, Brian's kind of go-to protocol for this is a nasal inhale for 6 seconds, an 18-second breath hold, and then a 12-second exhale. And there's something about that apnea protocol, apnea just meaning the absence of breath, that really starts making me yawn after about 3 or 4 minutes and really helps me cycle down at night when I need it most, especially if I've been writing late. So again, slow nasal inhale and exhale, pretty even. Try to go for 7 to 8 seconds on the exhales. That's the simplest way. And then that 6, 18, 12 protocol, all nasal, if you want to take it up a notch. And if you can't get there, you're like, I can't hold my breath for 18 seconds. It makes me claustrophobic. It makes me feel panicked. Okay, well, maybe you just dial the numbers back. Start with a 3-second inhale, then go for a 9-second breath hold, and then go for a 6-second nasal exhale. And just practice that and see how it goes for, you know, try it every night for a month. If it's working for you, great. If it isn't, just start tweaking the variables. So maybe you eliminate the hold and you just do a shorter inhale and a really long exhale, again, nasal. Okay, well, maybe that works for you. Maybe it doesn't. Maybe you want to add in a longer hold. See if you can do that. Just start playing with the variables. But I think just being conscious of your breath in and of itself is pretty relaxing, which is why in fixed point meditation, in cultures and religions around the world, breathing is one of the most common anchor points for such a meditation.
Yeah, I think that's... Even now in the supplement industry, you're seeing a lot more sales of things to get people to relax more at night, from even, you know, ready to drink beverages to whatever. I mean, that I think is going to get, probably never will surpass pre-workouts, but I've seen a huge uptick in that area for exactly the reasons, you know, you mentioned. We're pretty good at using stimulants, and now we're trying to use a similar solution to calm down at night, where I know I've tried to work on meditation off and on. I started, the first time I ever did any breathing practice was from Andrew Weil's book, like back in the mid-90s. And it wasn't until, you know, probably 5, 6 years ago that I've been able to do some form of practice, you know, semi-daily. And I noticed that, along with the walking we talked about, makes like just a huge difference. And it's a little bit of a harder sell, because I noticed I needed initially to do longer time periods before I could feel a difference. And I think one of the appeals of the Wim Hof method is you can feel a difference from breathing in a very short order, right? So that kind of changes a little bit of the psychology of, oh, there is some leverage here. But I agree that a lot of times that's still in the area of, upregulation only, where most of my clients, if I could pick one, it would be hit them over the head with a magic wand to get them to downregulate at night and actually go to bed. So,
yeah, and I think that Brian starts to talk about if you're uncomfortable with any kind of breath hold, that's an indication of high sympathetic tone, which you know that, and I know that, Brian, more. But that's just saying that you... Two things could be true, and Patrick McKeown dives into this in Oxygen Advantage as well, that you could just have a low tolerance to carbon dioxide, right? In which case, try some of the Buteyko method stuff. Patrick gives away a lot of free information and resources, so maybe just listen to a podcast interview with Patrick McKeown, because it could change, really could actually change your life in just a few minutes a day. This isn't like some supplement sales pitch or whatever, but yeah, so Brian's thing is, well, in that case, just dial it back a little bit and work up from ground zero, right? So if you feel like, man, I feel like someone's strangling me just from any kind of breath hold, just dial it back to a simple, slow and easy nasal inhale, nice and calm and easy, and a slower nasal exhale. And if you do that for 3 to 5 minutes, it's going to start dampening down that high sympathetic tone and at least taking you in the direction of being parasympathetic. And then in writing this, co-writing this book called Align with Aaron Alexander that just came out, we found in our research that there was this long-range study in the UK done, I forget the university, but they found that reading is actually the most relaxing of all nighttime practices. And we're talking about a physical paper book. Like, okay, I get that your Kindle's grayscale.
I can't scroll Facebook.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly, right? But so then we start to do what we talk about in the book is, well, maybe you combine a little breath work while you're reading. And initially, it will be kind of hard to concentrate because you're like, oh, how many seconds is my inhale next exhale meant to be? Stop timing it or thinking about that. Slow and easy on the nasal inhale, slow and easy on the nasal exhale, and just read for 30 minutes to an hour. And again, start off small. If you're not a reader, read for 10 minutes before bed. But the key is here to really not overstress the duration on the inhale or exhale with the breathing. Make sure that it's nasal only. And don't be reading on your iPad or your computer, because we know from multiple studies, like see the work of Matthew Walker, Michael Bruce, Chris Winter, any of these sleep experts, that reading on any electronic device, even if you have Efflux running on it, even if you've got your contrast or your brightness dimmed way down, your nighttime mode on your iPhone, it still delays sleep onset, it buggers your REM sleep, and it lowers overall sleep duration. So read a hardback or soft cover book, a real freaking paper book, and do a little breath work at night. And maybe a third layer in this little Jenga stack of habits is listen to music that you find relaxing. And that doesn't mean classic FM necessarily, unless you like classical music. You might find death metal relaxing. Seriously.
I do.
Okay. Or electronic music.
Yeah.
In which case, great. I personally can't read, write, or edit to lyrics. So mine's usually, you know, like BT or Ludovico Einaudi or something like that. But, you know, pick your poison. But again, just maybe start with the breath work. And then after a couple of weeks or a month, introduce the reading. And then maybe play around with, you know, dimming the lights a bit more, trying to cut out your blue light. And just pick one a month to go for, in the hope that you can improve your sleep quality and can downregulate better. And if you just do that, and then maybe during the day, your one habit is you take a daily walk, preferably outside, maybe those are your two big rocks for the year.
Yeah, and especially with, I think we can use technology to our advantage, which I know a lot of people, and I've talked to Andy about this too, they're like, but you wrote a whole book called Unplugged, don't you hate technology? And I think we can use it in specific ways, for example, of just looking at a step count. Right, you don't have to be neurotic about it. You don't have to track everything. You don't always have to have your heart rate monitor on, but it's collecting data kind of seamlessly in the background, and it may or may not be uber accurate. But if one day you get 4,000 steps and the next day you get 8,000 steps, and you find that by having a number, your compliance goes up a little bit, and you're, you know, not going to be neurotic about it. I've used that a fair amount with clients, you know, quite successfully, in order to just get them in the habit to give them a little bit of that feedback. And then hopefully you do it long enough that it just becomes a habit and they don't necessarily need to always be looking at the device either.
Yeah, for sure. And I think that even goes back to not looking at the clock, like I was saying with the breathing, because we start to see, like with sleep trackers, what's now known as orthosomnia, where yeah. you obsess so much about your sleep that you end up sleeping worse. And Brian McKenzie shares this story in Unplugged, parentheses, shameless plug, go buy it, folks, and you'll find out it isn't that we hate technology.
Yeah,
you know, that,
yeah.
that is the point. But it's what we're trying to say is that really the central crux of the book is technology can be useful if used in moderation and purposefully, and if it doesn't become the be-all and end-all. I think that's yes. really the cut and thrust. So even like I was saying, the simplest form of fitness technology we have other than the pedometer is or the step counter you mentioned on your Fitbit or whatever is a watch. And so people will say, oh well, I can't relax during this breathing, and we're like, are you timing your inhales and exhales or not? And be like, well yeah, because you said you need, you know. No, even if it is ideal to have at least a 7 second exhale, but our bodies are pretty good at gauging time and a lot better than we think. So again, slow inhale, slower exhale. That would be the protocol to start with, not, you know, 7 seconds in, 9 seconds out, or even the other one I mentioned. I guess on that 6 seconds in, 18 second hold, 12 seconds out, I've never timed it because I know it would make me more stressed out. So I think that, that you're definitely correct with the fact that it can be used to our benefit. And if a kind of technology, whether it's a sleep tracker, a Fitbit, whatever it is, an Apple Watch is helping you, a Garmin watch, you know, something real fancy, then fine, keep doing it. But you might also want to consider and check yourself if you're on Strava 3 hours a night and you're checking King of the Mountain, and you know, if you did this stage faster than your buddy and that becomes the only thing, and you never see your buddy because you're just kind of checking up on him and trying to one up him on your 500 meter split time or your mile split time. Well, again, choose FaceTime, real face to face over FaceTime. And that would probably be another keystone habit, because we know from the Blue Zones and Dan Buettner's follow-up books that being in authentic community that involves frequent face-to-face interactions, whether that's with your kids, your friends, your spouse, whatever, is one of the most underrated keys to not just longevity, but long-term vitality.
Oh, yeah. And yeah, shameless plug, I do this in the Flex Diet Cert of differentiating between formal exercise and recreation. And what I see, especially in the fitness area, is a lot of people are doing the mixture of both. They're trying to do formal exercise, but they're not really tracking the thing that they're trying to get better. Obviously, there's people who are, you know, spending the 4 hours a day on Strava that go too far the other direction, but they don't have any recreation at all. It's like, just, I don't know, go play tennis, go hang out with some friends, go for a walk, go for a hike, go mountain bike, in my yeah. case, go kiteboard, yeah. go stand-up paddle, learn to hydrofoil. I don't know. Just freaking pick something, go out with some friends, have fun. You know, like, don't worry yeah. about tracking it. Don't worry about your heart rate. Just go learn a new skill. Have fun. Chill out. It'll be good. Trust me. You'll thank me later.
Yeah, it's just going to raise all the boats, right?
Yeah.
And Kelly Starrett says that pull-ups are not a sport.
Yeah.
You know, they may be a component of certain disciplines I don't want to mention in case I get blacklisted, like some other friends and collaborators I know. We won't mention the name. We're tempted to, but we won't. But, you know, pick up basketball is a sport. You know, tennis with your cousin on a Wednesday at yeah. noon and your lunch break is a sport. So, you know, go cup stacking apparently now is a sport.
Oh,
what
my
kids were watching the other day. Yeah, so I don't know. Who knew, yeah. right? But, or even maybe, like we mentioned Alex Honnold and Tommy Caldwell and Kevin Jorgensen earlier, maybe your fun outdoor recreational activity is also something that you can excel in, you know, either on a competitive level or just for its own sake. So it can be both, right? But I think I find myself all too often, especially in the winter in Colorado when I can't stand up paddleboard because all the bloody lakes are frozen till May, that then the rowing machine came out 2 months early this year. And so I'm all too often just swinging a bell or on the rowing machine by myself in my garage, mm-hmm. particularly as my workout buddy's kind of under the gun at work right now. And so I'm calling you out, Roger. I'd like to see more of that. But in all seriousness, even if your friend comes over to lift with you, I know Travis Jewett, who's one of Kelly's lead instructors for what was, again, Mobility World, now the Ready State, for the courses they do, he just started having some of the neighborhood guys come over and lift with him. And they do some fun stuff. You know, they got some tires and
nice.
Do some throwing heavy things in the backyard. And kind of made it fun. But it doesn't need to be any more complicated than that. And so it just, I think too many times we're like, oh, I'm not sure if I really want to join that running club. Well, maybe you just call up a buddy from college who you used to run with every Tuesday and Thursday 20 years ago and say, hey, bud, you know, I know we're both kind of out of shape, but you want to go run with me? And I also think that we're, Gabby Reese talks about this a lot, that we're really afraid as adults about trying new things because we don't want to be embarrassed and we don't want to look stupid. Whereas kids, you know, they go on the monkey bars, they fall off, they laugh about it, get a little further, fall off, laugh about it, and rinse and repeat. And Aaron and I talk about a lot in a line. We have a whole chapter on play and playfulness. And to recapture that playfulness, we've got to drop the ego. And I'm this way. I minimize this. I don't like to try new things sometimes because I know I'm going to be embarrassed. Like even the other night, my soon-to-be 13-year-old, his homework assignment was like basically pick your parent who's worse at math and teach them this concept and then have them take that test. And I thought, my wife's like a math genius, as was her dad and as is my youngest son. I don't want to be embarrassed in front of them. So I just made him teach it to her instead, even though she was the one that taught him the concept. So that's a great example and a silly example, but I think it does hold that, you know, recreationally, we're afraid to go climb that artificial rock wall, even at the gym. You know, we got one at our rec center and I look at it and I think, oh, I'm kind of afraid of heights. There are these little 6 and 7 year olds going up there like spider monkeys. I'm going to make an ass of myself. I'm not going to try that. But yet I'll go watch Honnold and Caldwell and others on these films and think, wow, I wish I could do that. Well, I'm never going to learn to do any of it, even to get off the ground, if I'm too scared or I've talked myself out of getting off the ground because I'm worried about looking foolish or having to confront a fear. So not saying you have to go shark diving if you're afraid of sharks, which is parentheses one of my biggest hangups, but it just it really just starts with, I guess, kind of moving away from those, what Dr. Jim Aframel, the author of the Champion's Mind and someone I'm collaborating with more these days, calls cognitive distortions, right? Like we talk about maximizing our failures and minimizing our successes would be one. Just the overall habit of negative self-talk would be another. Catastrophizing, you know, these things that we tell ourselves and they seem true in the darkness, but if we were only willing to bring them out into the light, we would realize that they're all false, that we can do all these things if we were only willing to try. So this is something I'm constantly struggling with and I'm very risk averse and wish I was a better, more adventurous person. So it's, but I think it pertains to what we're saying, and particularly what you said about, well, just go out and, you know, try a new activity or a new sport or that new thing your kids are jazzed about. Instead of watching from afar, maybe you go and practice it with them or find like in one of these crazy pubs now that has like hatchet throwing, you know.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, what could go wrong? You combine Yeti Imperial Stout and hatchet throwing. I can't see how there could possibly be a problem there.
Yeah, I always tell clients, like, when even though just teaching them, like, a deadlift or a kettlebell swing, I did the original RKC, Pavel's from White Bear Lake, Minnesota, where I'm at here when he moved over. The first rep is going to be your worst rep. You're probably going to suck at it because you just haven't done it, right? So what makes you think that you would be good at it? But we all have this kind of intrinsic thing of, oh, we have to be good at it. And I find especially athletes who were generally pretty good at picking up new skills, it's sometimes harder for them because they're going to have to struggle a little bit more. I guess in my case, I just assume I'm going to suck at everything the first time, and I normally do, and I just, I'll just keep trying it till I figure it out. I'm on year 3 of trying to ride on a silly hydrofoil, you know? But it's a fun process.
Yeah, I mean, even I had to go and go and learn to properly swim for the first time in my life a few years ago. And I would be in the pool and there'd be little, you know, kids that were on the swim team, my kids' schools just buzzing past me in the lanes. And, you know, I was struggling not to drown. And so I guess that would be one example where I have overcome that. But there's a lot of other things I look at from afar and think, that's awesome. And then I just kind of indulge in it as a casual fan. And that's as far as it goes. But I think that, yeah, and really just, you know, Aaron said throughout the process of writing a line, like, I think this comes back to us needing to become more childlike and have that childlike sense of wonder and discovery and awe and just be willing to try anything as kids usually are. And we just get, you know, so rigid. And in writing this thing with him, I realized that I'm far too rigid and far too unwilling to look foolish. And so I think that, you know, like I said, it's an ongoing process. But for most people, again, that if you're going to be active in some way and you can make it fun, you're more likely to come back and do it again. And if you come back and do it again, it's going to have a knock-on benefit to your health. But that shouldn't be the main thing. The main thing should be just going and doing it with your friends or your family and making it fun.
Yeah, totally. Awesome. Well, thank you so much for being here today. Greatly appreciate you sharing all the wisdom and all the lessons and everything that you've learned. Where can people find more about you?
Oh, that's a tricky one.
So or maybe they don't want to find you. Just buy your books.
Yeah, yeah. Like after this rambling, espresso fuel rant, they're probably like, oh, that's the last thing I want to do. But yeah, so my good friend and collaborator, Kenny Kane, who is Andy Galvin's host of the Body and Knowledge podcast, he and I went down a pretty deep rabbit hole with getting off social media for a long time because we believe that it, for the most part, makes people less fit, healthy, and well, which is kind of his mission as a coach. So I've recently dipped my toes back into the waters and I'm kind of doing a reverse fast where I dive back in and see. So yeah, I guess, just all the major social media outlets at Phil White Books, or at philwhitebooks.com, which is my website.
Awesome. Well, thank you very much. Greatly appreciate it. Thanks for coming on.
I really enjoyed the conversation. Thanks so much. And, appreciate you asking intelligent questions. It's been good.
Cool. Thank you. I really hope you enjoyed that interview with Phil White, and thank you so much. Again, if you want to get on the newsletter to stay up to date on everything that's going on, go to www.miketnelson.com. We've got a free giveaway at the top there also. And wanted to leave you with this very short clip from Phil. A lot of times there's really cool stuff that doesn't quite make it into the quote-unquote formal interview. This is as we were talking before we officially started, but I loved it so much I wanted to include it for you here at the end. So here's Phil with the final thought. Thank you all so much. Have a great day.
You might focus on the differences between all these people that have had the chance to kind of apprentice under, I guess you could say, whereas really what I've started to see, and I think Kelly sees this as well, are more the commonalities.
Yeah.
And so, and also just the whole big rocks notion. It's like people think that there's going to be this magic bullet, one supplement that's going to, you know, completely revolutionize their sleep or enable them to lose weight or whatever. But it's like we've been majoring in the minors for far too long. And in doing so, we've missed the wood for the trees. So I think that, that kind of idea of, okay, well, what are some of those big rocks? What are some of those common threads, like the red thread that I see among all these experts in human performance, and then what's the practical takeaway from that?